Good evening. We're recording live from 941 Madison Avenue, and I want to welcome our listeners to the Freedom Not Just Another Word show. And here with me today is Jalel Smith. Do you want to say hi?
Yeah, what's going on, people? What's going on?
And before we start our show on the theme of freedom, I just want to say a few thank yous in case I run out of time at the end. I want to say thanks to Mary Sweeney, who taught me how to do my audio editing, and Sarah Wagner and John Brummett and everyone at NPR, and Joe Loya, who you're going to hear from later during the show, who is the author of The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell. And he's also the only bank robber that I've ever hung out with. Tony Schmiesing, I want to give him a big thanks, and he can be found online at the blog FasterBarnacle.com. That's FasterBarnacle.com. And if you are a sailor, or you know a sailor with a boat who has a really adventurous spirit, that person will have good reason after hearing this show, or hearing about it from you, to go to FasterBarnacle.com and perhaps decide to participate in Tony's amazing adventure, which we'll be talking about. Also, thanks to Chris Oliver and Ann Mullen. And again, huge, huge thanks to Jalel Smith. Am I pronouncing your name the way you like to hear it?
Just the way I like it.
Good. Jalel was on a kind of spontaneous show 2 days ago with me, and I invited him back to read some, he's basically going to be acting. We're going to reenact some interviews that I did at a juvenile hall, a juvenile detention facility in Northern California. And I'm not allowed to use the names of the kids who are locked up there for obvious reasons. And
that's why I'm here.
That's why I'm here. So I'm back at the mic. Okay. So we're going to do, what are we going to do? We will have him reading the words that these kids spoke in interviews at Juvenile Hall. And true, his accent is from the Bronx. Straight from the Bronx. But he will be playing the part of a lot of different kids from Northern California. And he's got one accent. And the kids I spoke with, they spoke like, you know, some of them sounded like middle-class white kids. Some of them sounded Hispanic. And, you know, some of them sounded different than that.
The list goes on.
The list goes on. And Jalel's going to be playing all those parts. And so why don't we start with that, and then we'll do a little of that, and then we'll move on to our interviews.
Okay.
So, Jalel, if you want to start.
Okay, sure, no problem. That's it. The people that aren't in jail are the most free. You know why I feel that way? I think rich people, they're freer than the poor people. They could get themselves out of a lot of situations way faster than we can. They could buy themselves a lawyer, anything. They own it. My soul is free, meaning, how can I explain that? Even though I'm locked up, God won't let my soul be incarcerated. Everyone over 18 seems more free. They don't got to listen to their mom anymore. Am I free? Here? Nah, not really.
Has being locked up made you feel differently about freedom?
Yeah. Actually, because I was taking advantage of me doing whatever. That's why I'm in here.
Okay, great. We're going to go back to these words from kids at Juvie a little later in the show. And again, that's what you've been hearing. These are voices that have no way of getting out to you. And so I thought we might listen to them on here because I'm not making much sense right now.
But it's all good.
It is so all good. So let's start with listening to Tony Schmiesing, and he tells his story, but I'll just mention that Tony broke his neck in the ocean, diving into the ocean when he was 16 years old, and he's been a quadriplegic ever since. And on his blog, fasterbarnacle.com, he actually describes that moment of breaking his neck as perhaps the most beautiful thing that has ever happened to him, which is a startling statement. And so let's listen to what Tony means by that.
You said, speaking about when you broke your neck, at what age? How old were you?
16.
At the age of 16, you said, as catastrophic as it may seem, it's the single most beautiful thing that's ever happened to me. And can you elaborate?
Well, I love who I am now, and I love what my life has become. I have no way to know what my life would have been had, you know, I not broken my neck. But I look at my life here in Berkeley, and it's so rich and it's so fulfilling. And I'm a positive person. You know, I don't believe that there's anything that I can't accomplish, and I think that part of that is foundational from my parents and the love that they gave me and being an athlete. So when I broke my neck, there was never any time of depression. You know, I never felt like I wanted to die. I never felt like, why me? I basically just moved forward. You know, I just said, you know, okay, here's a problem that I need to overcome. And part of that's that rehab doesn't allow you much time to think. You're working. And at the time, I also wanted to graduate with my class, so I had to take classes while I was in the hospital. And so those things, I think those things instilled in me a lot of confidence. When I look at my family, it brought us together in a way that I don't think anything else could have. You know, I've talked to my parents about this, my father and my sisters, and especially my parents, because when you're 16, you're kind of in your own world, you know, at that place. And certainly at that time, I was somewhat adversarial with my parents, too, because they're sort of the other, and I wanted to do a lot of different things, and they probably wouldn't allow me to do them, and so blah, blah, blah. Having talked with them, my dad said, you know, it probably saved their marriage. You know, because I think you can come out of it in two ways. One, you can flee from that, you know, you can flee from that disaster or what seems like a disastrous thing, or you can rally around it and come together. And it entailed a lot of selflessness, you know, on the part of my mom, my dad, my sisters, and my friends, you know, and I was shown so much love. I mean, so much commitment and so much love that it's hard to imagine anything greater than that, you know? I mean, I've got to go to University of California, Berkeley. I've gone to film school. You know, I've met some amazing people who've worked for me, amazing people who I've known. There, I've fallen in love several times. You know, I've had a really, really, really rich life. Mm-hmm. And I think when I look back and when I said, you know, what's the most beautiful thing that ever happened to me, some of that is from a perspective now, to see that, you know, that sometimes we have a tendency in our immaturity in this world is to look at things as good or bad. And I think things aren't good or bad. And certainly it's a mistake to judge them as that right away, because you just don't know what's going to come out of it. And later on in life, you know, you look back and you go, my God, that thing that seems so awful. I mean, I wasn't able to surf competitively anymore. I didn't go to my prom. You know, I was 16, you know. I was 16, you know. I mean, I was in my prime sexuality. You know, I wasn't dating then. My friends were. And so these were things that seemed pretty big, but I look back and I go, my God, though, I had no understanding of what that event was at that moment. So that's pretty much what it means. That's why I think that.
So here's the question, I guess the most simple question that I've been asking people. Tony Schmiesing, are you free?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, very much so. Because I have no limitations, and I don't. One of the things that I don't allow to happen in my life is I don't allow people or other things, I don't even know what you would call them, to influence my happiness and whether I'm going to be happy or not. That comes from within me. And it's funny, when you told me that you were going to do this on freedom, I there's so many things about it. There's this abstract idea of what freedom is to me, and there's a very literal idea of what freedom is to me. And you probably read on the blog too, is that about probably like 15, 20 years ago, I started having problems with pressure sores, which are very common for people in wheelchairs. And my lifestyle changed dramatically. I mean, I went from being, you know, up till 1 o'clock at night and partying, being out with friends and doing whatever I wanted to do, to suddenly being in bed 70% of the time. And that is, I mean, in some ways, I mean, I would jokingly call it a linen prison, because I really was in my room all the time. And, you know, I suppose I could have been really depressed about that and saw that as an enclosure, but that would be ridiculous. Why would I allow that to dictate my life, how I was going to feel? Because I could feel happy wherever I'm in, if I'm in a box or if I'm paralyzed from the neck down and I don't have any arm movement or whatever it is. So that's why I feel very free, because I don't feel like I have anything holding me from doing what I want to do.
Tony Schmiesing, are you free?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, very much so. Because...
Whoops, inadvertent loop happening there. Let's listen to Tony now explaining about this pretty amazing dream that he has, something that he is sure he's going to accomplish, and I don't doubt it in the slightest. And again, if you are a sailor or you know a sailor, this would be great to pass along the link to this on the internet to them so they can hear about Tony's dream.
Could you describe your the dream that you're currently pursuing and how that might connect to the topic of freedom?
Well, okay. the dream I'm currently pursuing is to sail. There's a history behind where I want to go, but I'll tell you that in a second. I want to sail from New Zealand to Australia, and Australia to Fiji, and then hopefully from Fiji to Hawaii. Those places in particular are important to me because when I was 16, we were kids, you know, I was a surfer, and we had planned, my friends and I had planned to go to take a year off between high school and college. Who knows, we may have taken more than that, but to surf in those places. So I have this sort of romantic attachment to those places. Also, I've never been anywhere outside of the continental United States, outside of surfing in Mexico and having been to Hawaii recently. So that's a great place to go. You know, I've also wanted to go to Europe. I want to go everywhere, really, but I figure I'll start there. The sailing thing interests me because I can't surf, obviously, because I can't stand, so that's not going to happen. But a boat is interesting because you can get on the water and you can be interacting with waves and elements that are changing constantly, which is very much like surfing. And the people that I've found who sail and the people I've found who surf, they're very similar in that they have this passion for the ocean, and that excites me and that moves me to no end. So, I don't know, I just had this idea that I wanted to do this thing, which is absolutely crazy because I don't sail. You know, I mean, I've sailed, but I'm not a sailor. I looked online, I couldn't find anybody who's done anything like this. So there's that. So that's the general idea, but this is born out of the fact that when my pressure sores started to occur, I put off doing really adventurous things because I felt the quality of those adventures wouldn't be the way that I imagined that they should be before I started having the pressure sore problems. Not before my injury, because I don't think back to that time, because that doesn't make sense to me. But I kept thinking that it would get better, things would get better, and then if I wanted to go to Hawaii, like the reason I didn't go to Hawaii 20 years ago was because, I'm going to have to be in bed every other day, why do I want to waste that time? But that's ridiculous, because I'd much rather be in bed on the north shore of Oahu than in my Berkeley apartment. I don't even think there's a comparison. So I had this epiphany that's what this trip is about, is going, okay, look, this time has passed and I didn't do any of that. But I'm going to seize this opportunity because I'm still relatively young. You know, I'm still in pretty relatively good health so that I could do this. I know that it's going to be an extra challenge because I will have to be down probably half the time. You know, the challenges are going to be great. But I love putting myself in positions which are uncomfortable. And I don't mean uncomfortable like, you know, I'm having a pinched nerve. I just mean that I don't know what the outcome will be. You know, I don't know. It could go up good, go bad. It could go good. But I like that position. I like being there. And so this trip kind of, it's really about that. You know, doing something that is scary because it's unknown. And that excites me. And that's the complete opposite of my thinking before. And that I like. It's completely the opposite of saying, well, I'm not going to do this because it may not be that fun, or I'll be in bed half the time while I'm on the Pacific Ocean. I mean, to me, it's like bizarre that it took me this long to wake up to that idea, but I'm glad I did, you know.
Do you think it's a little bit of a throwback to how you used to live as a surfer?
It is. I mean, I feel like I'm reclaiming a certain energy, you know. I'm reclaiming a fearlessness that I had, and that feels more to my essence. You know, I feel there's a lot of things about me that are my essence, but that's a very big part of who I am and who I identify with. So when I do something like this, I feel like that's my true nature is this thing right now while I'm here. So that's kind of where that comes from. Yeah, I think.
I don't know if I made it clear at the beginning of the show. These interviews were recorded in the last couple of weeks in the Bay Area in California, and now I'm just playing them off my computer, little snippets, nuggets, chunks, and itsy-bitsy specks of those interviews. We have wonderful people walking by and waving at us while we're sitting here in the storefront window, and editing this material from Tony just reinforced my sense of how amazing he is and how amazing it was to spend time with him. And then here I am with Jalel, who I just met randomly 2 days ago. He was one of the gorgeous people walking by in the street with this huge smile. And I don't know, I think I have to go into radio because this project has just given me such
inspiration.
A deep, deeper appreciation for the beauty of not pretty much, of every single human being on the planet. So let's hear a bit more from Jalel, if I can, and from myself. I'm playing myself, the interviewer, and Jalel is playing one of about 15. There are about 15 different voices, actually, and so every time he speaks, it's probably a different kid expressing something about freedom. In response to one of my questions, I'll describe the scene a little bit. I went to this one section of this juvenile hall where I volunteer sometimes, and they were playing bingo that night. And I think the prize was something very sugar-filled. There's a lot of sugar that goes on at those facilities. And anyway, the people who worked there were really nice, and I got to talk to these kids one at a time, any kid who wanted to speak with me, and they were actually pretty eager. And I think sometimes when I was talking to them, one or two of them actually kind of got tears in his eyes and got a little choked up, and I think we all know what that's like when we're getting a lot of attention from one person and talking about things that are important to us, sometimes it can be pretty emotional. And if you imagine adding to that being 13 to 17 years old and maybe away from your family for the first time and living in I've spent a tiny bit of time, probably under a minute, in one of the rooms these kids sleep in with no windows, really tiny. And so you can imagine how it might feel for them. And so as he's reading, you can also imagine some of these faces and sometimes choking up a bit as they were speaking. And these kids were so generous with me and, you know, full of all the same beauty that I see walking by me here on Park Avenue. So let's go back, Jalel. And do you remember where we were?
Actually, I do.
Okay. Will you show me? Okay, great. Thanks. Oh, so after I talked to this one kid for a while, it suddenly occurred to me to ask him the following question. Has anyone in your family ever been in prison?
Yeah, my uncle, my brother, and my dad, they were arrested too many times, but then they got deported. I don't look at prison like it's bad. It's just another place. I think if you are especially free, you're probably dead, because you're free of all your worries. That's pretty much the freest you could be. Freedom is like no restraints holding you back from nothing, being able to be like you.
And then here's a question I asked a lot of those kids, and I asked both my interviewees. It's a pretty simple question, and it's also probably one of the harder, stranger questions that any of us will ever be asked. Are you free?
To what extent? I'm like free to do everything, to do anything I physically could do. I mean, I'm not free being in hell, but like, I really can't explain it.
And then another kid said,
yeah, like I changed my mind about the lifestyle I'm living. Because the way I'm going, I'm making myself less free to achieve things I do before I
die. And then later he
said, I'm free to think. Angels are the most free. An angel is a person that goes to heaven basically and flies free, basically with no troubles and no sin.
And then I asked again, this other kid, are you free?
Not at the moment. But I will be on me first.
And then I asked a kid, what kind of people are the most free?
The hippies are the most free. Basically, because they don't go to work. You are a slave to work. They were free. When you're free, you don't gotta worry about nada. I think that's it. You don't gotta worry about how you're gonna eat. Nobody tells you what to do. Do whatever you want. You actually have freedom here because you're not thinking about cigarettes or sex or alcohol. I'm kind of free, but not really. It's like a different free. You only live once. Take advantage of it.
Thank you, Jalel. And we'll come back to these words from kids at Juvie in Northern California in a second. But the on the whole, you only live once note, we'll listen to a little bit more from Tony. Let me just see.
Tony Schmiesing, are you free?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, very much so. Because I have no limitations, and I don't, one of the things that I don't allow to happen in my life is I don't allow people or other things, I don't even know what you would call them, to influence my happiness. And whether I'm going to be happy or not, that comes from within me. And it's funny when you told me that you were going to do this on freedom. I there's so many things about it. There's this.
That was a little bit of redundancy, and we'll just call that conceptual art. We're going to call a lot of our little mess ups in this show conceptually based. So let's listen to Tony on talk about the idea that people, well, let's first listen to him talk about his love for life and his fear of death.
I was there was a time where I was afraid of death, and this was probably 10 years ago, because I really love life. I really do. It's so cool. And I couldn't imagine, like leaving it behind. That's attachment, you know. That's something that I don't want to be attached to things or people or things like that, because and I don't mean that in like the Buddhist sense. I just mean that it's these people are going to die, they're going to go away. These are things that are just going to happen in life, so you need to be able to accept that. And I had a friend die of AIDS, and it was like one of the worst things I've ever seen. This was in the 80s, and it was horrible to watch. The things that happened to him was just crazy. And I had a dream that I died in my dream. I was suffering from a really bad illness, and it was at that point where everybody, you know, you see in the movies, everybody says, "Oh, just let go, just let go." And I tried to let go, and then I was going somewhere, and I went, "No, no, I don't want to let go." But then I wanted to think about, like, you know, death. What am I afraid of? Why is it so scary to die? You know, because we're all going to die. I mean, it's just something that's going to happen. And I don't know. I thought about it, and I don't know if it's meditated on, but I gave it a lot of thought, because I didn't think I should be scared to die. I thought that's really ridiculous. And then somewhere just it clicked in me that I wasn't afraid to die. I don't want to die. I mean, I don't want to die tomorrow. I mean, but if I die, I die. I love life. I don't think it's something I want to do. But if I die, this is the way it goes. I die. And I feel that's a good place to be. Maybe that's freedom in many ways. You know, once you let that go, once you let go of the fear of the death, you don't have to worry about anything. Hardly have to worry about anything anymore. To it, I think, you know, it's part of everything that's informed me and given me the strength of who I am now. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I feel connected with surfing as I do the ocean, you know.
Well, Freud said something that I think was really dumb and wrong. He associated he didn't always do this, but there came a point where he started associating the...
Freud, dumb and wrong, what?
Yeah, really.
How is that possible?
Anyway, he associated the oceanic, that kind of feeling of oneness, with the death wish.
No, I wouldn't say it's that. Yeah.
Anyway, it's interesting because all the ways you're describing the ocean, which seem very accurate, that it's surprising, it's uncontrollable, it's mysterious, I wonder if, you know, that is really a way we could describe every part of the world we live
in. Yeah, sure.
If we could only, somehow, you know, experience it that way,
yeah.
Everything could be that. And I guess the fact that now you're not literally surfing, but you're still you have this hunger to be at your edge and to be doing something that feels a little bit impossible. Maybe that's a way you're kind of making the world into more of an ocean or an oceany. I'm not
yeah.
Oceanic.
But I also feel like, you know, that I always want to be growing, you know. That's part of the thing too. I don't want to be stagnant, you know. And I feel like part of I feel fortunate that I can do this, you know, that I can make this opportunity happen. And I feel that, you know, any experience that I have, especially experiences that I've never had before, they're going to change me and challenge me and make me grow in ways that they're completely unexpected, and that excites me.
Okay, let's backtrack now and listen to Tony talking a little bit about the ocean and what he terms the electric edge of fear.
What about the ocean appeals to you so much?
The thing about the ocean that, I mean, I don't know what it is. I mean, it's part of who I am. I mean, it's been part of who I am since I've been a very young child. So, but I think the thing that I love so much about the ocean and why I like surfing so much and challenging myself there is because as much of a, there's so many things about it that are beautiful that just speak to me in a way that I can't really describe, but one of the things that I can say is that it's entirely unpredictable. It's the thing, that's why my neck is broken, because I didn't respect that, despite its my mastery of it in many ways, it's much more powerful than I am, you know, and it doesn't play by the same rules. It doesn't have any logic to it. It just is what it is, you know, and I think that's why I like it so much, is that It's always unpredictable, and it's always challenging. It's always interesting. Sometimes it's really calm and beautiful, and you just, you're in awe of that. Other times it's just, it looks angry and scary, and when you're in it, you're frightened, you know, and you're facing things that you wouldn't otherwise have to face on a day-to-day basis. So in that respect, I like it for that too. But I love that place where this is the idea of this, you're right up to that edge of fear. You know, you're probably not, things aren't going to go wrong. But they could. You don't know. They could. And I love that place. It's so electric to me.
Okay, now that we have heard some from Tony, and time is already running a little bit short, I want to spend some time with my other California interviewee, my other main one, Joe Loya, who, again, I think I mentioned he robbed banks for several years, sometimes more than one bank a day. Any thoughts about that, Jalel?
That's pretty ruthless.
That is pretty ruthless. And he eventually got locked up himself, spent 7 years in prison. Two of those years, Jalel, he was in solitary confinement. So let's hear him talk a bit about prison and about that confinement. Again, this is Joe Loya, the author of The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell.
Prison was liberating because I could focus my imagination, I could focus conversation with myself and other people in ways that before I went to prison, I was governed by compulsion. I was going here and there because I was insecure. I was a fugitive, so I had to make decisions based on, you know, my fugitive status. I was actually out of control. I felt no control. I couldn't focus. I was operating by improvisation all the time, but improvisation, like I said, that was compulsory. And so there was too many things weighing on me when I was free robbing banks and all that stuff. When I got to prison, I got put in solitary confinement. Like I said earlier, the density of that confined space after being in there for a year, it just crushes all the clutter in your head. And now you don't have voices from the past. Conversations are more difficult to access. A lot of the stuff that made you insecure before, it just really focuses you in ways like it focuses you on the smell of your body. It focuses you on the condition of your body. It focuses you on the smell of the cell. You know, you're just confined in that space.
One thing that Joe spoke about or speaks about in his book is living on the other side of taboo. And when I spoke with him in California and also reading his book, I learned about quite a few taboos that a lot of us take for granted that he has actually broken in his life. So I want us to listen to him talking about that in relation to the question of freedom.
I had already participated in incest with my aunt, taboo. I tried to kill my father, taboo. And clearly, I was an outlaw, breaking all manner of laws, taboo, in its own way. There were ways in which I was literally, but when I say other side of taboo, I just mean I was living where civilized people have a border. And they say, we're not supposed to go on the other side. Whatever that line is in society, I was living on the other side of it. It freed me from obligation to society, for one. I didn't need the mores of society. I didn't need to be governed by them anymore. So that obviously was freeing. You know, my borders had before been this village, and now I was going into the woods. And in the woods, I would discover the animal in me. I would discover all the things that civilization is meant to, the darkness in us is meant to keep in check. And so, living on the other side of taboo, I learned so much more about myself. I learned so much more about those people in the village, especially about why they're afraid to come over here, and why they were right to fear people coming over there. We are detrimental to them. We are a major threat to them. And so there's all these rules and stuff to keep people civilized so they don't start taking each other's shit, so they don't start stabbing each other, so they don't start taking their kids off the street, raping them and killing, you know, just, there is this part of us as human beings that we're supposed to keep in check. Living on the other side of taboo is enlightening, utterly enlightening, and in that way your imagination is liberated, and you become unfettered morally, unmoored morally, whatever you want to call it, and that is liberating. Now the thing is, that is not necessarily a good thing. Though it was liberating, it's not necessarily a good thing. There are other reasons why we are told to keep these things in check. And that is that the animal in us is ferocious, and the animal in us is without conscience. And once you do certain things yourself now as, you know, sentient beings, you behave in certain ways that damage your imagination and alter the way you imagine yourself, and seriously alter the way you imagine yourself, and in that way seriously damage your relationship, the way you comprehend yourself in relationship to the world. And so when you try to come back to the village, you feel you've betrayed them in such a way that you feel like an outsider. You feel like you don't belong in there. You feel like you, like I did for a long time, what's the word that I use? Like I was unfit for it, but not, that's not necessarily the word. I disqualified myself from it. Mm-hmm. And so even though you could put me back in society for a long time, I felt like I didn't deserve the goodness that I was looking for. And that is a difficult place, because when people come out of prison, for example, you can give them a job and you can give them a car and you can give them a house. You can give them you can make their landing as soft as possible. But the thing is, because we have lived on the other side of taboo, it's difficult for us to imagine living peacefully in here. We feel like frauds. And that's where people in their imagination can't make the leap, and therefore they lurch back. People are very simplistic, and that's where, having lived on the other side of taboo, my understanding of the comprehension of us as human beings, full human beings, the contradictions, all the paradoxes, the complexity, the lies we tell ourselves, the way we compartmentalize things about our identity, I'm down on that. I know what it's all about. But the other thing too is, as I walk down here, I sometimes feel bad for the images I have in my head of the damage I've done to people. Literally, sometimes faces of people who are begging me not to hurt them.
You talked about kind of leaving the village and being in the woods, and I know a lot of us really carry the village inside of us, and it seems like we would wherever we went. And maybe certain traumas from when you were a child kind of push that out of your consciousness. I'm just wondering how much you... And you also talked about kind of struggling with using the religion that had been handed down to you to try to redeem
yourself. The language
yourself.
And metaphors of it, yeah.
So, but I just wonder how much you carried the village inside of you with you into the woods and...
But wasn't aware of it.
Yeah,
I carried a lot of it. My early years were incredibly happy, so I was actually conditioned to happiness, to joy, to innocence. I was conditioned to it. My mother died. My dad couldn't handle grief, so he became incredibly abusive. I was molested by my aunt and was involved in a sexual relationship for her for a while. My mother died. Trauma after trauma after trauma. Just eventually I shut down emotionally. I was like, I can't handle the world. It's beating me down. And so I shut off and I tried to kill off the part of me, because the early part of me was sentimental. It kept getting me in trouble because I kept being optimistic and I kept being slapped down. And so my defense mechanism against it was like, I refuse to be innocent anymore. I refuse to be optimistic. I refuse to be fooled because I'm a nice boy. And so, just real quick, I shut that down. And by shutting it down, I didn't get rid of it. I thought I stamped it out. I went to a place and I was like, good, I'm no longer that boy who can be duped by people. In fact, I enjoy duping them and making them look like fools, like I felt when I was a boy and the world made me feel like a fool. I love turning people into idiots. I love turning them into like people who are like, I can't believe that just happened to me. That's why when my life intersected with somebody's life violently, I love that moment where they were like, oh my God, I'm here. What do I do? You know, I love that moment of shock. Loved it because I realized my story trumped theirs like instantly. They didn't know what to do. They were fooled by my niceness that ended up abusing them. Anyway, the point about the village carrying with me, that boy, I carried that ball boy with me, and that ball boy ushered in a long period to this day of good emotional resources to allow me to be more successful than most guys who come out of prison, allowed me an occasion to begin to belong. I had skills and resources I got as a boy who belonged very firmly to a community. I was socialized. I was sociable. I understood the rules of it. So when I came back to it, the village, early years in the village, absolutely helped me.
Let's hear Joe now talking about his moment of madness, which involves this apparition, which you'll hear he calls a hallucination, of a boy who he knew as a child who had cancer and had lost his hair.
The biggest thing that emancipated me was madness. I just started going crazy in there. I started hearing voices, the walls started moving. I was having hallucinations of a bald kid in my cell. It was really, really that emancipated me.
Did the bald kid speak to you?
No, I just stayed in my corner and it felt so real. It was intense. It was a hallucination. People say it was an angel and all this stuff. I was like, yeah.
Can you say more about why or how the madness was what was liberating? And were you afraid that it wasn't going to stop?
I was petrified that my mind was fragmenting and it would never go back to normal. I thought I was going, I thought I was going permanently crazy. But after this bald boy showed up in my cell, I started writing. Because I remembered that this bald boy was some kid I had known when I was a youngster. He died of leukemia and he was bald before he died. And he used to wear this wig on his head with scotch tape. He would just take it off once we got to his clubhouse. And that memory came charging forward and I started writing about it. It's the first thing I wrote that would end up in my memoir. And so the writing, based on that experience, was emancipatory, but also I realized that I couldn't control my mind. All this feeling of control that I had, like I could move people around. If I didn't like them here, I could shove them, I could stab, I could make people do what I wanted.
By intimidating
them? Or attacking them. I was an attacker, I'd stab people and try to kill my dad, stabbed him. I was a violent person. When I was robbing banks, the sheer force of my violence and my aggression would make people cower. So I knew that I could control people through intimidation, through violence. And I felt like I had chosen this life, chosen to be the Ubermensch, chosen to be somebody who was this intellectual outlaw as well as, a physical outlaw. And so there was this sense of myself that I was choosing this alienation, that I was choosing this antagonism against society, antagonism with society. I felt like there was choice, that I controlled my destiny, even though I controlled it to solitary confinement. Nonetheless, I felt control. And when I started losing my mind, I was utterly humbled. It made me realize, I can't control my mind. Who the fuck am I faking here? Come on, Joe, you can't deny it anymore. You're totally out of control. And that was emancipated. The being humbled so thoroughly, I just had to relinquish the notion of control, and I submitted to humility, and that was the emancipation. That was the emancipatory moment for me. So that's what I mean by solitary emancipatory.
Why do you think, you know, since we're jettisoning the idea of some kind of angelic messenger, why do you think that particular figure is what came to you? Have you reflected on that at all? Or why would that figure of a child who's lost his hair and is on his way to dying, have you thought about why that's what
The way I comprehend it, the way I've come to understand it, because what occurred afterwards to me is what reveals the purpose of that moment. And what happened afterwards was I wrote about him, and in writing about him, I remembered that street, Deland Street in Pico Rivera. And there was other things happening at that time. My mother had not gotten sick yet. This was when I was 7 years old. She would get sick soon after that. And this was the last time I had a healthy relationship with my mother. And that was loving, and I was this really amazingly innocent, sweet boy. And so I had a flood of memories of innocence come up on me. And in that sort of, you know, squalor of the prison cell, and having, like, thrown my shit on guards once, and being, I was in there for a homicide investigation anyway. I ran with a bunch of guys who, you know, we got in trouble, and I was eventually cleared of it, but nonetheless, it shows you the degree to my involvement in prison. And you know, I just became somebody so committed to the concept of evil that the idea that once upon a time I was actually innocent, there was a history that I had tried to stamp out. In that moment, it just asserted itself into my imagination again. And in that moment, when I was humbled and started to document and chronicle my innocence, the concept of housing innocence that might overcome all these years of badness, that was eventually what occurred. I started seeing myself as, okay, if I want to change, I don't need to appropriate some doctrines outside of me. I don't need to study Islam or Christianity or Buddha. I don't need to study anything outside of me. Apparently, inside of me, somewhere in my body, somewhere in my history, somewhere in my concept of myself, there is this impression of innocence. And what I need to do is I need to find it, and I need to nurture it, and I need to bring it up, and I need to glorify that time. I need to give it its space. I need to recognize it, and in that way it would defeat the bad in me, the aggression in me, the self-hatred, the hatred of the world. And because that, from that moment, I became who I am now. So when you ask me what that boy was about, I look at what followed, and that to me is what it was. He was my entryway into Deland Street, which was my entryway into recognizing that I had once been innocent, and that it was it was possible for me to now conceive that I could access that innocence again, nurture it, and be healed by it.
Let's go back for a moment to Tony, and we're running out of time here, and I want to make sure there's so much great material I got from both of these men. So let's listen to what Tony has to say about people being able to overcome things. Again, this is Tony, who had a catastrophic accident when he was 16 and broke his neck, and now is planning to go on a huge and amazing sailing adventure, perhaps with the help of someone who's listening now, who has a big fancy boat somewhere. It could happen. It will happen.
When I see people not living to their full potential, you know, I mean, I wish that they would. I mean, because I firmly believe that people can overcome any situation they want to. It does not mean it's easy. Some people have it a lot harder, and their obstacles are a lot bigger than everybody else. But I feel that, you know, that's just the way it is. That's just life. Some people get it harder than other people. Some people are born into extreme poverty. Some people are born to drug addicted parents. Some people have drug addictions. But if you, I feel it's a waste to give that, to give up like doing stuff because it's difficult to do. I think that's what you're asking, you know, like where you put obstacles in your way. You go, I can't do it. I don't want to go. I want to do that. It's too difficult, or whatever the reasons you use. I mean, to me, that's silly, because you have so much power. You have the freedom to choose to do it, and it just takes effort. It just takes work. It may be painful, because growth is often painful and change is painful, but generally, the reward is so wonderful when you get to the other side of that. You know, you get back much more than you put into it, I think, in the end. What is a carrot and what color is it?
The thing is, it's like you're almost, to some degree, assuming that people who resist their freedom have, there are actual impediments in their way, but I think most people, it's self-created, you know,
yeah,
myself
yeah.
included. It's yeah. all really good for
yeah.
me. I need
no that. People do create their own obstacles, but I mean, there are certain facts that exist, you know, and it's important to be aware of those facts. But I don't, you know, for example, a kid who's born in a very impoverished situation in ghetto has to walk through, has a mom who lives with a single mom who works all the time. You know, she doesn't speak English. I'm throwing like some big things out there. This kid has to go to school every day, has to walk through an area that is very difficult. Then they have to go to school, they have to study, they have to come home. Maybe they have to work too. You know, maybe they have a disability too. I don't know. I'm just throwing some things out.
What's
that?
Kid
yeah.
Name?
Yeah. No. Maybe the kid has a name like xylophone, which even makes it even harder.
Or spatula.
Sure. Spatula. Then there you go. I've named my dog Telephone. So you know. But you know. So these are things that are harder than say the kid who I was when I was a kid. I grew up near the beach. I could ride my bike to school, didn't have to worry about anything. My parents were together. They were there to help me with my homework after I got home. I was in water polo, surfing, I was doing all this stuff. So there are certain obstacles that I didn't have. Now, you know, some people don't break their neck. They don't have that obstacle to overcome. They break their neck and they don't have pressure sores. They don't have that obstacle to overcome. So there's some very real things that you have to go through that are not just self-created. They're physical barriers. But that does not mean that they're not able to be overcome. That's all I'm saying. Just maybe more difficult. Because mm-hmm. people can make excuses all they want and say, you know, I got this and this. But the fact is, yeah, you can do it. You can do it. It just takes a lot of work. And generally speaking, as our species that I've seemed to notice, we don't like change. Even dogs don't like change. I don't think spiders like change. You know, they resist it, you know. But we can choose to better our situation. We can choose to better ourselves if we want to put the effort in.
Let's hear Tony again talking about freedom as choice. I don't know about you, Joelle, but I can't get enough of hearing either of these men. They have such great things to say. Any thoughts?
Yeah, that's a true story right there. You got me thinking.
They got me thinking too. So let's listen to this. Freedom as choice is what I labeled this part of the interview.
Well, I would define freedom first and foremost as a choice. Freedom can never be taken from you. Because if your idea of freedom is limited to your physical self or like a space, then you're not free. I mean, so I feel that freedom is there for everybody, so it never can be taken away. So I guess you know, the best definition I can give is it's choice. You can choose to be free, or you can choose not to be free. You can choose to be free in a prison. You can choose to be free. You can choose to be free, you know, if you're in a nursing home. You can choose to be free, you know, if you're a tax collector. You choose to be free if you're an NFL football player, whatever.
You know. What do you mean by freedom? What would that look like? Somebody in a prison cell or anywhere else who was free. What does it mean specifically? Is it still? Do you mean still connecting to the happiness and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's kind of where it is. I mean, thank God I've never been in a prison. You know, I don't want to go there. I mean, I don't think it would be great way to spend my life. But I can say on a far less level than that, it's being in a bed for a long period of time, not being able to go out, or being completely paralyzed, which I was for several months after my accident. You know, I don't know, I just feel that life is more than this thing, my body, this thing, and the space that I occupy. It's stuff going on, you know, at a deep level. And so, for me, I just feel that it's about how you want to see things, how you want to live, how you want to be happy or not happy. I mean, if you're in a prison, you're in a prison. That's the fact of life. You cannot change that. I mean, you can try to escape or not. So how do you make that the best, most ecstatic experience you can have? That's the choice. I don't know how you tell somebody how to do that, but it's purely a mind state, you know, more than anything.
So rather than thinking of freedom as freedom from all limitation, you could define freedom as freedom to choose within any constraints or parameters.
Yeah, how you want to feel. I mean, I think for myself, you know, I want to feel thankful. I want to feel like in a state of rejoicing at this point. I want to feel that way. I want to feel grateful for this life while I'm here, you know, and that's happiness, you know, that has a lot to do with it, you know, and so I don't want to allow things to limit that.
Again, that was Tony Schmiesing, and earlier we were listening to Joe Loya, and I have so much more material from both those interviews that are really well worth hearing, and I'm going to try to find a way to get them up on the web so Jalel will be able to listen to them from his home in the Bronx or wherever he gets online, and anybody else will be able to hear them too. I want to thank Jalel. He has been so helpful in the few days that I've known him, and is such a terrific person. I hope I never lose touch with him. And I also really want to thank Joe Loya and Tony Schmiesing for being so open with me, and both of them for teaching me so much. I'm really glad, if nowhere else, these interviews exist on my computer, and I'm going to be able to listen to them and realize my own freedom, hopefully, on a much deeper level. And what else do I want to say? Honestly, the beginning of this show didn't go how I expected, and I was a little disappointed in myself for losing track of things and things being a little chaotic. And that also is very related to freedom, because it brings to mind something that helps me be free. And I'm gonna teach this to Jalel right now over the air. I took an improv class once, and we were taught that if we were in a scene on stage or just playing around with friends and we messed up, we were taught, instead of kind of folding in on ourselves and feeling bad about ourselves and berating ourselves for messing up, we were taught to stand up and kind of take the posture of an Olympic gymnast after they get off the bars or the horse, and stick your chest out and put your arms big and say with a huge smile on your face, huge smile, say, "I fucked up." And you just say it like you're so happy. "I fucked up." And what's great about that is that you stay open and alive and present for the next moment. And so in the spirit of freedom and self-forgiveness, I'm going to sign out. And thanks again to everyone who I mentioned at the top of the show, Mary Sweeney, Sarah Wagner, John Brummett, everyone at NPR, Joe Loya, Tony Schmiesing, Chris Oliver, Ann Mullen, Jalel, and also Shaquille Taylor, who I met on the E-train, who meant to make it over here today. And if you ever hear this, Shaquille, I wish you really well. Okay, thanks a lot, and maybe it's a question that we can all contemplate a little bit more. Are you free? Thank you.